Hello, and welcome to The Buzz Factor, episode 40-something this week. We're definitely getting up there. Today in the office, we have Mr. Dave Carrot on Twitter.
Say hello. Hey, how's it going?
There we are, we can hear him. How good is that? Audio working first time this week. It looks like everything's working. Okay, we're going to probably keep it short this week, because, Hugh isn't here, and without him, there's just no life in the Buzz Factor. So, we've had a little bit of an incident down on Manor Street, didn't we? Looks like someone was hit, possibly. There was definitely an ambulance involved. We had some pictures sent up. Couldn't really see any, no blood or anything. I'll walk past there later and maybe live tweet if we
see
if
the
there's blood or something. Yeah,
yeah, like we had blood when the one outside our office, we could still see the blood on the street.
Oh yeah, that one was brutal. That was so for those watching the live stream, that was like kind of back towards for us. You missed the theme song. It's actually on 13.25 Twitter's Runners will never see that. It's called Venga Bus, and it's by a guy called Pirlo. And it's in the credits. So if you watch to the credits, you can actually see the exact name of the song, and then you can look it up. It's Creative Commons, so you can even, like, replay it as much as you want in your own house. yeah, you can actually broadcast it to people like we're doing. So, Dave, how many buses do you think we are going to see run red lights?
It's going to be a shorter show. Shorter. Yeah. I think we're going to have 6.78.
6.78. I'm going to go way less than that. I'm going to say 3.
A whole round.
Yeah, I'm going
integer.
Whole number.
You're going with stick with integer.
Hugh is listening today, and I don't want him to get mad at me. John Milksville says hi, Dave, as well. We're not going to replay the theme song. We will, actually. We will. Any second now. Tell you what, if you can wait it out, Mr. John Milksville, I guarantee we will play the intro song again. The little trick is actually the outro song, too.
Boom, boom, boom.
Okay, so 3 and 6 point, what did you say, 6.325?
78.
6.78. Okay, so, well, I mean, if someone gets hit again, they might, who knows, there could be half a body strewn across somewhere.
Yeah, that's why that ambulance was there. We did see buses, like, fully blocking the intersection, not actually paying attention.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, hey, Cynic.
Just got a bike about to ride around the bus.
Is he?
Because he's not behind the bus anymore. He's just popped out.
Oh, look how many, see... People just, cars don't give a shit when the lights change, do they? They're just like, I'm already in the intersection, fuck it, keep going. Some cars. Okay, let's jump into some news. How we want to do this? It's on a bit of a hard to see angle, isn't it? Let's start with the tech news, because we've got a decent amount of stories here today, which when we started, we thought there wasn't going to be anything. Big news of the week for me, I guess, is the HP ILO exploit. Do you see this one, Dave?
Yeah, saw this one. You just sort of go, at the ILO, and it pops.
That's exactly right.
Shell.
You just literally are at it. So this is a pretty standard buffer overflow. If you do an extra header, like a connection, and the idea is you'd normally say, like, connection keep alive. Yeah, John Booksville got it. Connection keep alive is what you normally put there. They had like a 20-something byte buffer. And the idea is that if you put in 29A characters, it'll overflow the buffer into the next element of, I presume, the struct or possibly the stack. And an A corresponds to, fuck yeah, you're authenticated. 0x41, yeah, that's fucking authenticated. So 29As, like connection colon space 29As, bam, you are authenticated. So pretty sweet little bug. And this is over the... HTTP API.
So this on is the ILO.
On the ILO, yeah. So it's the ILO HTTP API. So not we've seen a lot of bugs like this with the ITME protocol itself, where you can do like if you just put in a username of blank and a password of blank, it'll be like null authentication, mate. Sure, that sounds good. A lot of bugs like that. But this is over HTTP. This was patched May 2017, but we've just seen the disclosure now. But here's a good question for you. Dave, when you do a pen test job, how often do you see people are patching their HP ILOs?
I'm just trying to think of a time I've seen an up-to-date patched ILO.
Yeah. I have the opposite. I've had situations where ILOs have been so old, they don't even have the console functionality. So I can't hack them. They'll be like, oh, you can reboot the server with like a virtual disk image. And I'm like, I don't really want to do that in someone's prod environment. Can you just give me a console? And it's like, oh, no. You need a like 5-year-old later ILO for that, mate. I've had that happen. But yeah, never patched ILO. All these cars here are backing up a little bit. Lights haven't changed yet. Oh, there we are. Yeah. Number in the way. So yeah. But I have seen actually... Whoa, John Milksville, keep your language safe for work. He said, "Your fuck stop exe." I have seen a patched HP ILO already, so I guess it does happen. What's next here? Backdoored Docker. You want to take this one, Dave? You see this briefly?
Yeah. I think over the weekend, someone found another 15 Docker images or something that were mining cryptocurrency.
Oh,
out
wow,
of the box.
15 of them. And do you know how many downloads they had or anything like that?
Nah, I can't remember how many downloads they had, but It's a bunch. And it's just the whole thing of people will just download whatever off Docker and think it's all okay and not actually pay any attention to it.
Yeah, it's hard to make that kind of risk assessment because really you're trusting the person who uploads it because you can backdoor an image. So you can just pick a way to backdoor an image. There's an infinite number of ways to do it.
Yeah. And then you just pick a popular piece of software that currently doesn't have a Docker image and you put it up there and people go, oh my God, that's a Docker image for this piece of popular software. I don't need to set it up anymore. Excellent.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah. The original one that kind of kicked off this, like people actually searching for it thing was, I can't remember who it was, but they had like literally millions or something like that. Or maybe not millions, maybe hundreds of thousands or something of downloads before anyone noticed. We saw like a while back in the PyPy repository, someone also had some dodgy stuff. It was like the SSH, one of the popular SSH libraries would send your creds back to a server. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. So this kind of like backdooring of supply chain stuff, it's been happening for a while, but it's kind of, I don't know. It feels like nowadays we're very much more, hey, just download this code from the internet and run it. Whereas I feel like 10 years ago, if someone was like, here's a Linux ISO from a random company, just run it, people would be like, fuck no. Now people do it. So
yeah, and I know some stuff I've looked at for work, you know, they just have the requirements.txt and they say, run requirements.txt, thumbs up,
yeah,
go. They, you know, the whole supply and build chain now is just download all the external libraries at runtime,
yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a reason we do it. It's like easier to manage dependencies and fucking if this happens, well, fuck, you're fucked. But yeah, someone said Supermicro charge to get their ILO updates. So I guess that's going to be like annoying to do. And supposedly your fucks.exe is like an HP ILO reference, a little Metal Storm tweet. If you look on the video, you'll get the idea. Okay, what was next on the list? Chromecast location. Oh yeah, so Krebs put out a pretty nifty little story. It looks like someone else did the research, and he just kind of published it, which, you know, good on him. The technical details weren't super clear, but from reading Krebs's article, it looks like you can do like an unauthenticated request to a Chromecast device and receive back where it thinks it's located. And the way it figures out its location is based on the nearby Wi-Fi networks. Oh, yes. There we are. That's number one of the week. Okay.
What they'll do is the JavaScript running in a web page could start actually querying the Chromecasts.
Yeah, because there's no authentication, so it can just hit any of the Chromecasts. And then the end result is that those Chromecasts will look at the nearby Wi-Fi networks and So I guess the difference is if you're doing like IP address or something that tells you city, country, maybe. If you're doing a Chromecast and you're in a city with a very unique subset of Wi-Fi networks, that tells you the exact location, essentially. So a pretty nifty little thing. Originally, Google said, no, this is actually a feature. Of course, feature, anyone on the internet can tell exactly where your location is if you use a Chromecast. They kind of rescinded that and said, oh, okay, we'll put you a fix for that. It's pretty simple. You can just be like, the location API is hidden behind authentication or something.
Yeah, or you do what I do. My Wi-Fi network is a separate subnet from my actual wide LAN, so...
But they can communicate still. So
yeah, they communicate, but by the way, from the main code is only searching that. I mean, someone's going to search in a /24 in JavaScript, yeah, sure, fine. Now...
/16.
Yeah, now you've got to start searching /16, or
I'm going to count that as well.
Yeah, I'll count that one.
Yep.
Or, well, you've got to search the /8, the /12, and the /16, because, you know, you put things in different places.
Yeah. Okay, what'd someone say? I have an odd way of saying Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi? How do you say
Wi-Fi?
It? Wi-Fi. Wiffy. I generally say Wi-Fi. I feel like that's not.
Or are you pronouncing the dash in between the Y and the Fi like the Bishop Fox style guide tells you to?
Wi-Fi. I might say like Wi-Fi. I might kind of more emphasis on the Fi, like Wi-Fi. That could be what I'm
for
doing.
The high fidelity in his voice.
Wireless. What does it stand for again?
Wireless fidelity, isn't it?
Really? It's a weird little.
Yeah,
I've. Made by Australians. Yeah, hi-fi, Wi-Fi, yeah. The Chromecast thing's kind of interesting anyway. It, also, like, if you're using the Chromecast in the moment, then sucks to be you because people can do that, but meh. Okay.
Shall we jump across to the bus?
Someone just got hit. That was us changing lanes.
Without looking.
Yeah, someone just got hit on Manor Street in our lane change. Bus news. What was this about, Dave?
Bus news. Well, while we're just talking about Google and locations, we might as well start talking about Google Map license fees.
Mm-hmm. MetLink, they do charge for it.
Yeah, MetLink is the organization who sort of looks after public transport in Wellington, and currently their website and their app uses Google Maps. And they have been cruising along about $1,000 a month.
Pretty cheap, given like all of Wellington uses MetLink.
Yeah, they're saying about 2 million API requests a month.
Yep, that's a decent amount.
Yeah, Google has given them a new price.
Sure, well, they're 1,000 at the moment, so what, 1,500? 2,000 at the worst?
Just 30 times, so it's now 30K a month.
30K a month. That is a significant blow to your budgeting if one of your vendors is like, hey, it's now 30 times the price. That is, it's definitely significant to deal with.
Yeah, so the monthly price is over double the previous yearly price.
Yeah.
So I suspect they've got a really urgent piece of work now to replace it with OpenStreetMaps.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about the cost of a project like that, because you could probably get an OpenStreetMaps replacement done for, I don't know, $100K? And then how long, that's like, so less than a year. You'd make back your profit in less than a year if you were MetLink, I think, just going off what I would guess that they're charging. For
yeah, the numbers, yeah. And if you've already got, that, depending, I don't know how different the Google the Maps API is and the OpenStreetMaps API is. So, but then I'm not sure whether you actually have to start serving up the OpenStreetMap yourself.
Yeah.
So you might also have additional costs in the actual hosting of it as well.
Yeah, and places like MetLink tend to be fucking horrible. Like, you know, most places, it's just like, oh yeah, put some shit on S3 and Cloudflare in front of it and it'll be like, you know, $200 a month. Places like MetLink for some reason have to be like, oh, we have to go to this vendor that charges us like $500,000 a month. You know what I mean? Like, there are some companies that just seem to like expensive vendors. Auckland is using OpenStreetMaps.
Yeah, the Auckland's equivalent, AT, I think it does here, uses OpenStreetMaps. I'm not sure what Christchurch uses, but...
Yeah, so someone says either you run your own tile servers or you use one of the third-party ones. So I'm guessing they'd probably want to run their own, but who knows?
Who knows? But also, it depends whether are they going to... the other white tile servers, so long as the list around the 1K mark a month.
I maybe they could just do something with Auckland. So Auckland has to be either paying for their own tile servers or paying a third party. They could probably get together and, I mean, I doubt they would because fucking bureaucracy. But two big New Zealand companies using it that big, like, why not just combine?
Yeah. Yeah, just, and also the other thing is you can really strip it down because you only need to serve up. Or also if you put good caching in your app and in your website, you're generally only going to have to serve up a couple of tiles because only Wellington, right?
It's so a pretty small area you have to actually worry about. So yeah, maybe they'll end up just, they could use a third party service with their own cache or something. I'm sure they can sort it out. They got tech people there. Someone said that the DNS rebinding stuff, which people have been talking about. So yeah, there was, it's not actually on the news. People have been talking about DNS rebinding again. This was kind of talked about a bit when Tavis was looking into it. Tavis Ormandy was looking at it for some BitTorrent clients. Now, one thing I think people seem to be like, or maybe I'm misunderstanding, but one of the big things I think people seem to be not super useful on, you don't need DNS rebinding to do an attack like this because these are unauthenticated endpoints on the Google Home thing. So it doesn't matter whether you have a DNS rebinding thing that you can use on it because you can just hit 192.168.1.whatever and get that content back because you're not sending cookies with it. So the cross-origin stuff, it's unauthenticated. It doesn't matter. Same with most routers, right? Most routers don't have a good CSERF implementation. No cross-site request forgery token done properly. The session cookies are probably done poorly. So you can pretty easily just, without any DNS rebinding, do an attack against a home router. So, I don't know, DNS... No, so someone says, won't same origin prevent that? Same origin policy prevents things like making a request and viewing the... making a request with the cookies and then viewing the response of that. You can... like, any website can make a request to any other website. It's up to that. The browser will do things like not include the authentication cookies, right? And that's the issue with this Google Chromecast thing, is that it doesn't matter whether you include the authentication cookies. You'll still get a response back from the Chromecast, and that response will contain all the information. So, like, doesn't matter.
Yeah, if you have, it's pre-auth. This is a pre-auth web page.
Exactly. And then with, like, routers, you can make, if you do, like, an HTML form and you do, like, a post, you can't read the response back or anything. So, oh, fuck yeah.
That's a good one.
That should count as fucking two. That was crazy.
Yeah.
That bus tried to distract me from talking about this. It doesn't matter that you can't get the response back. Three, I'm currently winning. Because you don't need the response back if you're doing something like adding a new user, right? And then you can use JavaScript and blah, blah, blah. Same origin policy definitely helps. It stops most of the things. If you don't have CSERF tokens, same origin policy ain't gonna do shit for you. I mean, it'll do something and we'll stop some attacks. But generally speaking, you need robust CSERF tokens in conjunction with your browser's same origin policy. Someone says, Auckland Transport uses Smart Track. I think I know one of the guys who works at Smart Track or something. Sounds familiar. Okay, where do we get up to? OpenBSD hyperthreading. Do you see OpenBSD has turned off hyperthreading?
Yeah. I mean, they were scared of Meltdown and Spectre and stuff, particularly in the hyperthreading stuff. So it's only the hyperthreading, not the multi-core stuff they've turned off.
Yeah, because if they turned off multi-core, like, that'd be fucking... I mean, turning off hyperthreading still, like, fairly... it's a big performance hit on some CPU architectures, like x86, right?
Yeah, well, and a lot of the Xeons and the i7s, which are the higher-end stuff, are all hyperthreaded, so...
Yeah. Sorry. But what? Yeah, we talked about that last week, yeah. This is to do with how the hyper-threaded cores share L1 cache and that kind of thing, you can do cache timing attacks. I did see briefly someone was talking about presenting at Black Hat some attacks. I think it was this OpenBSD bug they talked about exploiting it. And the way they did their timing attack was from machine learning. So they used machine learning to... learn about the different timing profiles So rather than just like literally having a script that times it, they machine learned the different timing profiles or something. And I thought that was like kind of cool.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. I mean, but then again, I know SQL Map does that time thing. It will, if you've got a time-based blind SQL injection, it will try and figure out the optimal time to do to get through as fast as possible with the right number of false positives. And
yeah. I guess when you're operating on the same core as well, the timing requirements like different, you know.
Yeah. SQL Map is much more granular. It's like 1 second, 2 seconds, 4 seconds, 8 seconds.
Yeah. Someone says, there's also been discussion that maybe they're just going to let CPU reads for a single process still run on hyperthreading. Upcoming attack, TL bleed. What are you saying? So there's also been discussion that maybe they're going to let CPU reads for a single process still run on hyperthreading. Do you mean like, so if a process has two threads running, just run them on the same core with hyperthreading, and that way it'll still get a decent performance increase as long as it's the same process? Because that kind of makes sense, though. Like,
the risk is a lot lower. The fact,
well, essentially zero, right? If it's the same process,
it's the same process. Yeah, might be a little bit of an issue. I'm not sure how the sandbox in JavaScript works.
Yeah. Okay. True. Yeah. Same process, different sandbox, JavaScript. Yeah, like fucking web browsers just make everything harder, don't they?
Yeah, but then the web browsers have actually put in some of their own security measures related to it, so
yeah,
that may mitigate some of that risk.
Yeah.
And you can make assumptions that if you are on a server, right? I mean,
yeah, it does change things. Yeah. I mean, hyperthreading is not raw threading anyway, so I don't know what the performance stuff would be. And yeah, so that's the talking about using like multiple threads, CPU threads on one core. The scheduler, I don't know, like I've written like a fucking process scheduler once back in uni, and I feel like it wouldn't be like the hardest thing to make something like that happen, but still, like, I probably wouldn't want to do it myself. What else is here? Directory traversal on Rails. So one of the dependencies of Ruby on Rails, the thing that builds your assets dynamically. So the idea is like you have a bunch of assets that get minified and crunched up and all that kind of thing, and Ruby on Rails has like a tool chain for that, and you generally run it before you do your final like deployment to Brot or whatever. There's a mode you can enable that will do it on the fly. So as requests come in, it'll try and map them to the assets on the disk. It looks like there was just a trick reversal in that where you could say, hey, I'd like the minified CSS file, which is called /etc/password. And this minifier would be like, yeah, bro, here's that file you wanted, all minified for you, all ready to go.
Yeah, but it wasn't the default setting.
No, so this is a not default setting. And it's also a reasonably rare thing to enable because the performance impact. Like, why would you not just pre-compile your minified assets, right? So it seems unlikely many people would have enabled this in prod. But I'm sure someone would.
I call it.
It was a short. I wouldn't report it to Metlink, but
it definitely was. It counts as a bus factor red light.
Yeah, it does. Or I'm still winning. Still winning. And you said 6.8 or something, didn't
6.
you?
6.78.
Still, it's over 6.5.
I think if we get one more, is it?
Yeah. One more. Yeah, I think one more. Yeah. What else we got here? So, yeah, directory reversal and some Rails stuff. OSX encryption has been in the news lately. So what's this about, Dave?
Well, what this is about is you've got your OSX laptop, like a Mac Pro or MacBook Pro or whatever they call them these days, you plug in your external encrypted drive. And then you know how quite often you'll get the image thumbnails and stuff like that.
Yep.
Yeah, it will actually cache those images on your primary hard drive, the one in the laptop. And if you haven't encrypted the one on the laptop, now the metadata and the thumbnails for your encrypted images are now actually unencrypted.
Yeah, so this is an interesting little mismatch of features, I guess. And I guess, so other distros, I mean, like Linux generally doesn't do previews, not like cached ones, but it's possible some of the Linux file browsers would have the same flaw.
I think some of that would most probably end up in tilde.cache. Images end up in there.
Which I could see, and that's not going to be encrypted if your home directory is not encrypted. Of course, I feel like Well, I don't know.
Windows, on the other hand, is thumbs.db.
Which is stored in the file itself. I mean, directory. Mac for a long time has used like .ds store as well. Same kind of idea. And that's going to be stored on the encrypted hard drive. That's like kind of nice. But I don't know, a little interesting mismatch of features. And I guess, like, it is a bug. They should definitely fix it. But also, I personally just encrypt on my main hard drive as well.
Yeah.
It seems like a reasonable way to fix that, just encrypt everything.
Yeah, so most probably the risk here is if you are that and you give this drive to someone else to get a file off it, that is most probably where the risk lies.
And then on their computer unencrypted, yeah it's got some good...
Which cases actually have the drive of your sensitive stuff on and have your throwaway drive almost if you're trying to give people shit, right? Yeah.
Also, like a thumbnail and metadata, like it's not often enough to completely destroy whatever you're trying to protect. Oh, yeah, fucking look at that. Easy, mate.
Yeah.
Oh, Metlink our way, as in Metlink go through the red light way.
Yeah.
Am I right?
You are right.
Okay, so we're up to 5. I think that might put you in the lead. 3, 4, 5, 5, 6. Yeah, it puts you in the lead. Damn.
Yeah.
And by slightly, 3 minutes left as well, so you won legit. Yeah, I don't know, pretty easy to fix. We got 2 more here very quickly. TapLock, the world's most secure lock.
Yes, and the vendor response to this. For those who don't know, this is like one of these Bluetooth magical padlocks with a thumbprint stuff.
So I've worked with some of these before. The Noki, N-O-K-E, is super robust, well-made.
Hardware-wise, it's...
Yeah, it was the software. I found no fault in it, and so did some other people, so it's not just me. But this one, the TapLock.
Yeah, it comes, I think, vendor quote of the year.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It is... this quote isn't quite right. I don't have it in front of me. It was the essence of the quote. This is from the manufacturer in an email to the researcher, was it's invincible to everyone who doesn't own a screwdriver.
Yes, which is, that's not what I want to hear about my brand new fucking Internet of Things $1,000 lock. Is it's invincible.
I don't think it was $1,000, but same diff.
Yeah. My new lock, I don't want to hear like it's invincible as long as you don't have a fucking screwdriver. That's a bad place to be. There's a number of attacks. So first of all, people talked about physical attacks. You can shim it. You can just cut through it because the metal they're using is incredibly weak. And then also the pairing Bluetooth key when you first go to play with it, it's just the MAC address. So
Which is broadcasted, so the app can figure out what the password actually is. Yeah.
So pretty bad on them. And yeah, poor vendor response. Very poor vendor response.
Well, no, actually they're quite accurate. It's like, basically there's an external screw and you undo the screw and the thing just goes falls to pieces.
Accuracy doesn't mean it's a good vendor response. Not in my opinion. Hugh says some Linux tools store it in the current directory as a file, kind of like Windows does, and some put it in a RAM disk and others put it in your home directory. Yeah. The last thing here, Flight Radar 24, the Flight Radar Enthusiast website, has been breached. And so they sent an email out saying, hey, change your passwords. Only affects users who have been around since 2016. So
before 2016, March the 16th, 2016.
So it sounds like they've done a bit of incident response, found out when it was an issue, when they got breached.
But I haven't seen this breach actually show up. I know about it because of the emails.
They notified about it.
Yeah, and they are only notifying their affected users because only a subset of my email addresses have been told about it.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see whether that kind of pops up on the interweb anywhere. But so far we haven't seen it. Okay, I think that is about it for today. So we tried to keep it short today. Keep it short. Cover the news. We've got over anything. Is there anything else you can mention?
No, I can't think of any news.
It's most of the news covered. We should be back next week. I have to find someone to speak.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can get some more desks. I'm thinking about bringing back Mr. Weblord Pepe. I haven't told him yet, so we'll have to see whether...
Is he on the chat to respond?
I haven't seen him on the chat. He might be sleeping.
I mean, if he's not watching the show, does he deserve to come back as a guest?
Maybe. He's a pretty good guest. I think we can probably bring him back. Since, Hugh is still putting his honeymoon above the damn podcast. I don't know what he's thinking.
Yeah. I mean, don't know what that's all about.
Yeah. Also, it looks like you did when the bus came.
Oh.
I think he made it. He was over just, the first. I mean, that was. He tied it
just on. I mean,
do you reckon he knew he was watching us and he was like, yeah.
Yeah, he had it up. He was going to give us a little tease.
Okay. I think we're about done for this week. We will catch you next week. And here we are. This final song here goes out to Mr. John Milkspill, since he missed it in the beginning. We'll catch you next week.
See you on the flip side.